Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will discover there some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm not a regular blogger, but when things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of Paul's first epistle to Timothy, one of three pastoral epistles that Paul wrote to proteges. Timothy is functioning as a shepherd at Paul's request in the great city of Ephesus. There he is his apostolic legate. He is first among equals, the shepherds of the house churches, constituting the elders of the city, and Timothy is their overseer. And Paul is telling Timothy, in order that he might tell others, how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and the support of the truth. Among his many instructions and what amounts in a very informal way to be a pastoral manual, Paul warns Timothy in chapter 6 about people. They crop up in every generation. They crop up in every culture where the churches of Jesus Christ are established. People who are off-center, who are off-base, who are out of line, who advocate a different doctrine, heterodoxy, not orthodoxy, who teach things that do not agree with sound words. The benchmark of sound words are those that agree with apostolic teaching, with the teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ in verse 3. They advocate doctrines that do not conform to godliness, that is, do not conform to a worship of God that is framed around right duties. Such people, Paul tells Timothy, are characterized by conceit. They pretend to know a lot, but they know nothing. One may be brilliant, but still may be described as knowing nothing if what they teach does not conform to the truth, if it is not agreeable to the revelation of God. Many of those that he has in mind have a morbid interest about controversial questions and disputes about words. He had one thing in mind in his generation, but that takes many different forms in other generations. They're concerned about irrelevancies, and out of those, out of their influence, arise envy, strife, abusive language, evil suspicions, constant friction between men of depraved mind and deprived of the truth. And these are people who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. They're always looking out for themselves and typically, characteristically, finding a way to line their own pockets. We see that today. We've got a term, a very pejorative term, televangelist, so reprehensible and so clearly about material gain, using spiritual things only as a platform to get into people's pockets. Great perversity. Paul says in verse 6, where we pick up, but godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. When he says godliness is a means of great gain, he does not mean in the financial sense, but in the spiritual sense. Fulfilling our duties to God as his creatures and his servants is fulfilling our humanity. Our God is glorified, and in the process, our lives are ennobled and enriched. When we get in line with him, and fulfill our duties by faith toward him. Truly, godliness is a divinely appointed means of great gain to mankind. But with this proviso, however, godliness must be accompanied by contentment, the apostle says. True religion and discontent with our lot in life, folks, they do not mix. There is, we said at the end of the last program, an inherent gravitational pull embedded in the lack of material contentment. That will inevitably pervert true religion, that is, true Christian religion. It will inevitably draw us off course. It will pull us into a vortex of temptation that can lead to ruination. What does Paul mean by a spirit of contentment? Well, he well illustrates it in Philippians chapter 4, where he said this, and let us adopt the same attitude. To this church that had been very supportive of him and his ministries, he says, in a certain context, not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I know how to live in prosperity. I've seen both, he says. I've been in any and every circumstance, and I have learned in any and every circumstance the secret by grace of being filled, and also the secret of going hungry. I've learned all about having abundance and how to deal with that in a godly way and suffering need. That's the idea. I can do all these things that he's just talking about through him, through Christ who strengthens me. In short, the spirit of contentment or satisfaction in a believer, it's not a matter of squaring our jaw, gritting our teeth, and maintaining stoic discipline. But that spirit of contentment, godliness with contentment, stems from faith. It stems from a worldview that says, in the Lord I am rich. In the Lord I have all one needs. God is sovereign. He's all-powerful in every circumstance. His dispositions are always benevolently intended, and they're all wise, whether I can immediately see that or not. So if I am in want, that spirit of contentment says it is by his providential arrangement. So I will glorify him by trusting his wisdom in allowing this privation. I will trust his power to relieve it, and I will trust his goodness, though maybe not readily discerned by me, through it. So I will be content, for God is superintending all of my circumstances. If I prosper, it will be by his goodness and grace. If I do not get caught up in it, as though I deserved it, nor allow myself to become so inured or so accustomed to abundance that I cannot be content with a lot less plenty, I will be in a good space. So I will be thankful and generous. And when abundance goes, I will be content with less. And many people have seen both ends of it. If we come at this whole issue with faith and with a Christian worldview, such as I just described, we can learn with Paul to flourish in abundance and in the lack thereof, knowing that God is good either way, and his providence has allowed these things for his glory and for our good at the end of the day. Well, in verse 7, Paul writes, so that we might get our arms around the transience of this life and its material benefits. He reminds us, all of us should remind ourselves, we have brought nothing into this world, so it should be evident that we will carry nothing out. In other words, he reminds us, our naked entrance into this life is a prophetic symbol of our naked exit. So the apostle reminds Timothy and the churches and its leaders, something we ought to always remind ourselves of. We're going to leave this world as bare as we entered it. So let us, the unspoken logic is, let us learn to focus on eternal priorities and the things above, not let ourselves get all agitated and worked up into a sweat and a perilous state of discontent about transient circumstances that ultimately don't matter. And he adds in verse 8, and if we have food and covering, in other words, by those two, he means the basic necessities, with these we shall be content. We shall be, that is, if we learn to see things as they are. We learn to see things above, things on earth, things eternal, things temporal, and recognize the distinction between them. In short, what the apostle says for a believer lowers the baseline of contentment. The American dream is not the standard. This is not where we believers inherit our piece of the rock, as the old Prudential ad used to put it. Folks, God never promised, his new covenant people a little piece of heaven here on earth in material terms. Let's bury that idea. Let's bury that heresy of prosperity theology that is so rampant in Pentecostal circles. We are eagerly awaiting the advent of Jesus Christ. Then, our riches and glory will come. Until then, our material circumstances, hey, at any given time, they may be better, or they may be worse. Let us learn, like the Apostle Paul, to be content in either condition. Sometimes God, in his providence, may grace us with a certain prosperity. At other times, he may see fit to visit us with a certain level of poverty. It may not be extreme poverty. It may not even be poverty, but certainly a lot less plenty. God has his purpose in each, and he is master of all. Let us learn not to whine, not to complain, not to get all sweaty, but to make it our purpose. This is the way we are to conduct ourselves in the church of the living God, which is the ground and pillar of the truth, to make it our purpose to maintain godliness with contentment. In verse 9, he adds, "But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge people, men use generically, into ruin and destruction." You know, ambition is a good thing. It's a good thing when it's driven by a noble vision and a godly motive. I have to say, however, that in most human enterprise, our ambition fails one or both of these tests of propriety. By that I mean a noble vision and a godly motive. And in no area of human activity does human ambition fail more so than in our relationship to money. Folks, financial ambition is a trap. Those who want to get rich, those who want to have abundance, those who want to have big fat bank accounts. The apostle tells us, and keep in mind, he is speaking for the Spirit of God. This is reality. They fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. There's the bottom line, and we see it all about us. There's a television show that I'm sure many of you have seen on one of the cable channels called American Greed, and it's just a litany of individuals who aspired to be rich. They wanted to have it all. They may have started out with good intentions, but the problem was they wanted to be rich. I've often mentioned an acquaintance of mine down in the Southwest. He was once very rich. He was a good man. Had a Learjet. Had a great big spread out here in Eastern Oregon, you know, like most such people. Properties everywhere. Business interest everywhere. Manufacturing, oil, and all of that. A good man. But back in the 80s, there was a big furor, so big that it came before Congress. He was not directly involved with the principals, but he got caught up in it. I don't remember what the settlement was, but in the final analysis, though he was never indicted for anything, he didn't go to jail for anything, he didn't get scandalized in that way, it ruined him. I'm not sure. I've kind of lost touch. I don't know whether he ever recovered, but it really messed him up big time. And I'll never forget him telling me at a later time, "Jim, I got greedy." Well, that was like him, just straightforward, telling it like it is. That was his nature. But it was a sad story. He got greedy. He was rich, and like most rich people, he decided that he wanted to be a little richer. And that led to temptation, and that led to some blind eyes. And in the final analysis, he got his britches split. and that was a sad thing. Let us all take warning from that. I suppose it might be possible for someone to want to get rich for the sole purpose of altruism. That is, many of us have thought we'd like to be rich so that we might help others. But I doubt it. It may actually start out that way, that our motive is others-centered, not self-centered, but there's something about the allure of money that has a way of turning it in to something ugly. It's kind of like the guy or the girl at the office who has this sympathy for women or for men in distress. Their motives initially are honorable and they're good, but the more time they spend with those persons, there's a high probability that what started out with the best of intentions ends up with bad intentions. It's just the fall line of human nature, and many a pastor has stumbled there. So, frankly speaking, the altruistic pursuit of wealth doesn't last long. Don't pursue it, ostensibly out of that motive. Just don't pursue wealth. If God brings it to you, take it, be thankful for it, and then use it as a good steward. All the paths of acquisitiveness are potholes of overexposure to strong temptations. Temptations like the neglect of family. Temptations like the neglect of one's soul. Temptations like the neglect of duties to God. Temptations like ethical compromises. All the paths of acquisitiveness are paved with traps. Once we attain wealth, we have to work as hard or harder to keep that wealth. We never master money, but in the flesh, money always masters us. And to most people, having it is no fun without displaying it. It's like a secret. It's awfully hard to keep it secret because it's not enjoyable unless we can tell it. And it's no fun having money unless somehow we can tell the world about it, or a certain part of the world. And displaying the wealth leads to spiritually harmful self-indulgence. And when we have that wealth that we were so ambitious to acquire, we find our heart is where our treasure is. Instead of being on things above, our treasure's here below. And then many foolish and harmful desires, as Paul says, like to be accepted by the in crowd, to be recognized for our achievements, to prove to all that we have arrived, to enjoy the high life, to flirt with the world without developing a romance with it, all that kind of thing. See, all these have a way of plunging people, just as the devil might drown a victim in water, plunging the victims of financial ambition into ruin and destruction. Folks, just put it down. This is not original with me. It's, in essence, what Paul's saying. If we chase money, all its demons will chase us. Just give up that project. It's not one good for you. It's not good for your family. It's not good for your church. And it's not good for the Lord. I don't know. I've heard many say it. But I wonder how few times wealth can be achieved and retained on an honorable basis. I do know that it's not very often. I've heard some say it never is. I wouldn't go that far. Abraham was one who was different. Isaac and Jacob, I wouldn't say that. But I would say that it's a very hard trick to come by a lot of money without going out of bounds, without closing one's eyes, without bending the rules. Well, in verse 10, there's a law etched in the moral constitution of the universe, and folks, we believers must not ignore it. It's often misquoted, but we'll get that straight right here. Paul explains everything by telling Timothy, he's to tell others, the love of money is a root. He doesn't say the root. He says the love of money, and unfortunately many believers, or professing believers at least, are infected by it. The love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it, money, they have wandered away from the faith. We see it in every generation. And, as he suggested above, they pierce themselves with many a pang. There are many roots of human evil. For example, human pride. Man's revolt against God is foremost among them. Sexual lust is another deep root of human evil. But the love of money is a mother of a whole menagerie of human vices. Just think, for example, because of greed, we have pimping and prostitution. Because of greed, we have a huge drug and alcohol problem, not just in our country, but pretty much worldwide. Because of greed, we have identity theft. We have auto theft rings. We have misuse of corporate funds. We have stock and price manipulation. We have price gouging because of love of money. We have these noxious telemarketing scams. We have income tax evasion. For the love of money, we even have war. And who knows what? I just scratched the surface. For the love of money, we have Hollywood with all of the cesspool and with the vile emissions, toxic emissions that come from that source, Hollywood, and what shows up on our television screens. If it didn't make money, it wouldn't be there. But it makes money. It enriches people. And they say, hey, if we don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. We may as well do it. We'll make the money. Organized crime, the result of money. Well, you stop and think, virtually every evil on the planet can, at one time or another, have the love of money as its impetus. So that we need to take seriously, for the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. It's worth noting that the apostle does not teach, and I emphasize this, that money in and of itself is evil. He does not say that, folks. Wealth is a neutral matter in principle. Its mere possession may entail 1,001 temptations, but the bare fact of the existence of wealth makes no moral comment on its possessor, though I repeat, it's fair to say, I believe, and many have said this before me, that most fortunes are probably tainted, by which I mean most fortunes are not in every respect honorably and fairly gained. Somewhere along the line, most fortunes were created because corners were cut, workers were underpaid, customers were duped and cheated, regulations were ignored, taxes were evaded, safety was compromised, and so forth. I don't mean all in every case, but some of those things. Now, again, I feel certain there are probably noble exceptions to that picture. Some don't concede that, but I would. But men of wealth don't usually attain that kind of money by being natively kind and generous and altruistic, except for show. But people of wealth, men or women, are generally proud, arrogant, cutthroat, and self-indulgent. Remember Leona Hemsley, Queen of Mean, who eventually went to prison for her illegal activities? The rare exceptions that stick out prove the rule. Some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith. He refers to a phenomenon that we technically know by the term apostasy. They did not lose the saving faith they actually possessed, but they drifted away from the faith they at one time professed. There's a transient superficial faith, as we see in the parable of the sower. For a brief time, temporary faith springs up in response to the word, but it lacks root, and when it's tested by the heat of the day, it withers away. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.